Okay, so as you might know, I've been exploring what I call the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are, in many ways, the Buddha's core teaching. He said that anyone who really has the correct view, the wise view, the right view, is someone who understands these truths. And as you may know, the truths are the truth of suffering. There is stress, there is difficulty, there is a subtle sense of discontent. There is also extreme mental or physical anguish. The second truth is the truth of the cause of this suffering, which in the Buddhist frame is seen at bottom as craving, broadly defined. A kind of drivenness, a chasing after experiences, going to war with what's unpleasant, clutching to, clinging to other people, craving. Then the third noble truth is the wonderful truth that I talked about last week, the good news that it's possible to bring this craving, broadly defined, and the suffering and harms that it causes to an end. And then the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path that both embodies that ending of craving and suffering and leads to it. Okay. In this talk tonight, taking my time with the sort of underlying, if you will, neuropsychology, the Four Noble Truths, I'd like to focus on one particular kind of suffering and its causes and some things we can do to undo those causes. And that's suffering related to fear, to anxiety, to apprehension, to worry, to alarm, to panic, even PTSD or trauma. So what are the sources of this fear and what can we do about it? So I thought I could talk a bit about this, hopefully do a little bit of an experiential practice with you and have some discussion about it. And also end close to 8:30. Mm-hmm. Good luck, right? I'll try not to be afraid of going over. All right. So why do we fear? Well, first of all, there's a distinction in psychology between state fear and trait fear. State fear is a response to some kind of stimulus, either an outer stimulus or an inner one. There's a spike of fear. Something happens, right? The fire alarm goes off. Someone gives you bad news. There's an unwelcome surprise. Suddenly you feel this weird twinge in your knee that had been operated on once before already. Something happens, right? Someone doesn't show up. You're trying to get something done and you're afraid you won't be able to do it. Okay, that's state anxiety. Then there's trait anxiety, which is more of a background quality of apprehensiveness or worry that's not so related to anything in particular, and in fact is continually often scanning for something specific to worry about. Okay? There are many sources of these, of both state and trait anxiety. One particular kind of source is the way over time that we become sensitized to things that are threatening. And with repetition, a relatively small thing can become increasingly alarming. Another major source of kind of a trait anxiety is the ways in which Mother Nature is continually whispering well-intended lies into our ears to be afraid, continually afraid, to be on our toes so we don't get eaten tonight. Animal ancestors, animals that just did not fear disease or death, or the things that would lead to disease or death, did not become our ancestors. They did not pass on their genes. And you might become aware, even now, of subtle forms of unease, apprehensiveness, vigilance, unsettledness, that are present in your mind right now, even when there's truly no basis for it. It's a very powerful practice, which I'll talk about a little bit more, to help yourself see what it's like to literally have a moment of consciousness with no fear in it whatsoever. If we're really, really aware of the subtleties of what's present in the mind, it's unnatural to do that. Mother Nature always wants us to be a little apprehensive, even though it's a kind of delusion. Okay. So with these as, you know, kind of background sources, there are other sources, of course, of either state or trait anxiety, but I want to call out these two processes, one of sensitization, the other as a kind of well-intended delusion of anxiety. What can we do about them? How can we help ourselves release the suffering in anxiety itself and not let that suffering be the cause of other things that are problematic? In other words, if we feel fearful, we often do things that create suffering and harm. If you think about anger, for example, very often what's underneath anger is fear. One of the breakthroughs for me as, you know, kind of a scaredy cat, dorky kid, was realizing that these big aggro characters, usually male, that felt very threatening to me, I began to realize, especially when I did therapy with them as adults, for example, I began to realize that what was driving a lot of that aggressiveness was fear. They were fearful. They were alarmed. They were actually quite anxious, and they managed it by being aggressive. Right? So, it's helpful to appreciate, you know, the underlying causes, right, of our own anxiety or fearfulness. And then what can we do about it? So I want to offer four refuges, four sources of help in our practice with anxiety or fear, so that we don't experience, so we experience less of the first dart, if you will, of anxiety. And also, second, we don't overreact to our own anxieties and make a bad thing worse. So the first refuge is taking refuge in the truth, in seeing things clearly. If you think about it, as we evolved, our ancestors could make two kinds of mistakes, right? You may have heard this before. On the one hand, you could make the mistake that thinking that there was a tiger in the bushes about to eat you, but in fact, there was no tiger there. The other kind of mistake is to think that the coast is clear, but in fact, there's something threatening about to get you. There's a tiger about to pounce. What's the cost of the first mistake? Needless anxiety. What's the cost of the second mistake? Yeah, no more mistakes forever. So there's a tendency in us to continually overestimate threat. And taking refuge in truth is a way to cut through what we might call paper tiger paranoia, thinking that it's threat level orange when it's really threat level yellow, chartreuse, or actually even green. So one thing a person can do, taking refuge in truth, is if you're feeling worried about something or anxious about something, ask yourself if you're worried out of proportion to the actual threat. How big is this actual threat? Because most people, with some exceptions, but most people have a natural hardwired bias toward overestimating threat, which is, in a broad sense, a kind of delusion. A second kind of truth to take refuge in is the truth, which is usually the case, that in this moment, you're actually basically all right. Most of the information coming into the brain originates from within the body. The brain is continually reading out the state of the body. And the body is usually telling the brain that there's enough air to breathe, that there's digesting happening, there's no mortal injury, we're not in agonizing pain, we're not about to die, there's no tiger chewing on our leg. That's the truth of things. The truth is that in this moment, we're actually all right now. That's another aspect of the refuge of truth. And a third aspect of the refuge of truth is to actually recognize that the experience of fear itself is, in the technical sense, empty. That's a term in Buddhism that basically simply means that experiences have this insubstantial quality in which they're made up of many parts, they come and they go, they're ephemeral, and they arise and pass away dependently. Things cause them to come into being, things cause them to pass away. So to do a little experiment here for a moment, if you could, we'll just take about a minute and see if you can just do something mild or moderate. Bring up something that you're worried about or locate a familiar background anxiety. And if you can, once you kind of are in touch with it, see if you can start teasing apart its elements. In other words, be mindful of the body sensations. So for the next minute, I'll just call out a few things to be aware of as you observe and unpack an experience that has fear involved with it. So tracking first the body sensations. Let's see if you can find the nuances of emotion associated with this experience of fear. Are there any thoughts also associated with the experience of fear? How about desires? You can also sense down to anything that's younger or softer or underlying the fear. Perhaps there's a deeper fear. And you can do the same deconstructing thing with it too. Being mindful of the experience, seeing the experience increasingly as an impersonal process that you don't need to take so personally. You can come on back if you like. One of the things that the brain is constantly having to do is take streaming, interdependent processes that intertwine with each other and what's called essentialize them. In other words, the monkey in the tree has to take all these pixels, as it were, landing in the retina, all these photons, and all the, you know, activations in the optic nerve and the, you know, the processing substrates of vision, take all that information and go and chunk it down into, essentialize it down into banana, right? Because that's what the animal has to do to function. That's what we have to do. Well, if we look, and that's a nice way to get through life, generally speaking, but it can also cause us a lot of suffering. And if we look more closely at experience and take the time to be mindful of it and unpack it, it's not so essentialized. It's not so brick-like. It's not so much like a knot. We tease the threads apart. We disentangle ourselves from it. And that's a truth that we can take refuge in when we directly observe the actual experience of fear without letting ourselves be swept away by it. That's the first refuge. The refuge of truth in three different ways. The second refuge is the refuge of resources. In that, for me, is the resource of action. You know, as a person and looking at myself and seeing other people, I think often we're afraid of things that we don't do anything about. You know, sometimes worry actually is a way to avoid action. So if there are things that worry us, we don't have enough money, we're worried about health, we don't think we've got enough, you know, resources to take care of a particular project, What we can do instead is to do something about it. That's really important. Another thing to resource ourselves with is to get a sense of the protections of us, the strong walls. Sometimes I'll feel a wall, or I'll feel like the earth is a resource. It's there. Think of what we have in our life that's so much, we have so many more resources than so many people have had throughout history. Whatever those might be, sometimes it's helpful to kind of go through a little list, like, okay, I have a driver's license. Okay, the door's locked, you know. Okay, my dog loves me. You know, other people are a major source of resources. You know, what are the resources in a person's life, right? And then also there's a sense of the resource of your own inner strength. You know, fear basically is a statement, is based on a discrepancy, a perceived discrepancy between threat and resources. That's the basis for fear. What can we do about it? One thing we can do is we can bring down the threat, both by seeing it more clearly and not having paper tiger paranoia, and also doing things to reduce the threat. But we can also deal with that discrepancy by shoring up our own sense of strength, by accessing our sense of determination, willfulness, touching that place inside, your whatever your animal is, that inner hawk, you know, that fierce grizzly bear that can meet challenges and has met challenges in your history, standing up for yourself, standing up for other people, or the strength to endure difficulty and not be beaten by it and still be standing after the storm passes. You know, accessing that sense of strength is really important, and also doing things that cultivate that sense of strength. Things maybe like a physical challenge or deliberately giving up a habit for a minute or an hour or a day to strengthen the will. Or to try to see yourself in a neutral way, as like a third party, to see how strong you've actually been. My personal experience of most people, frankly, honestly, in a lot of ways in my own history, me included, we tend to underestimate our strengths. Yeah. We can often see the strength in others, but it's harder to see the strength in yourself. That doesn't mean getting conceited or egoic. It means a kind of honesty and confidence about your own strength. So that's the second refuge for me. I just want to offer the refuge of resources in terms of dealing with fears. Now I'm going to move more into the deep end of the pool, okay? The third refuge that I want to name, and there are probably others too, but these are four that stand out for me. The fourth refuge is surrender. One of the scariest moments of my entire life was one night I was probably about 10 or 11 years old. And there was a lattice work outside my bedroom window, and there were vines on it, and the wind was blowing. And I started hearing this progression of sounds that led me to be convinced that someone was trying to break in. All right? And in my relationship with my parents at the time, I didn't want to risk the greater fear of being foolish and going, "Ah! Someone's trying to break in." No, that was not an option. But so, you know how you can get twirled into some kind of fear, especially when you're a kid? And so I finally got to the point where I basically I just said it, or it was there for me. If you're there, come and get me. You know? And a different version of that was one night I was convinced, I was younger, I admit it, that there was something under my bed. Like a monster, you know that feeling? And I finally had to lean over in that incredibly vulnerable way. You're in bed, and you lean over, your head's upside down, and the demons can eat your face, you know? And I was like, if you're there, get me. Quit screwing around. Come and get me. If you're there, I give up. Come and get me. You know, it's surrender. Oftentimes, one of the most powerful ways to deal with a fear is to surrender to the possibility. We don't prefer it. We don't wish it. We wouldn't wish it for someone else. Often we're afraid for what might happen to others, especially others we love. You know, we can accept that the bad thing really could happen. And in fact, there's probably very little, if anything, we can do about it. This plane might crash. I give up. You might not continue to love me. I'm really afraid of that. I could live with it. I give up. And even if it, you know, like, even if it kills me, I can accept that too. This business may not succeed. This project I've really invested myself in. I surrender. I give up. I accept the possibility. It doesn't mean I give up trying. Doesn't mean I'm lying about how much I wish this to be true, but at some deep level, I surrender. That's a profound refuge, isn't it? The refuge of surrender. It tends to really cut through a lot of fear. Okay. And then the last refuge, let me see first if I have anything else to say about that one. You know, it's like surrendering to whatever will be true. You know, surrendering to whatever is already set in motion to become true. And when we do that, there's this funny experience. I bet everybody's had it, where it's almost like something runs through you and grounds out. It's like, brrr, okay. You know, and there you are, still there. So that's the refuge of surrender. And then the last refuge I want to mention is the refuge of, for lack of a better word, allness. And what I mean by that is that when we fear relative to things, we fear relative to things, parts of the whole, right? We're afraid of this particular plane crashing, or that particular person dying, or this particular medical condition in ourselves, let's say, not being cured. We're afraid of that, understandably. We're afraid of the tree that might fall on our house in a windy night, okay? We're afraid of these things. And yet, if it's real for us, especially, it can not merely conceptual, although that's a beginning, but actually real in some sense, we can have a sense that, you know, bad things happen to parts of the whole, but the whole itself, the universe altogether, even stretching into realms that we don't know about perhaps, the whole, the allness itself, is never itself harmed because it keeps on going, right, as allness. And sometimes we can actually find comfort, refuge, in how we relate to parts that are at risk when we open into the comfort, as I said, that allness itself is never at risk. Now, obviously, people can use that as a spiritual bypass. You know, yo, dude, don't worry about that bankruptcy. You know, it's all allness anyway. Well, shut up, right? But on the other hand, if it's genuine, there can be a kind of comfort, you know, that the earth will keep turning, you know, it'll keep going around the sun. The universe, 13.7 billion years old, probably going to be around for another 50 or 100 billion years. You know, allness itself is never disturbed. Okay. So those are some offerings about fear, and I wondered if you had any comments or questions so far. Yeah, great. Please, yeah.
Regarding allness, you were talking about, I just wonder if you could talk about the direct experience of that, you know, where it shifts your identity from, you know, a small sense of self and the relationship of that other larger identity with the, you know, conventional self. If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first off, people write about, thank you for repeating the question. So what's this experience of allness and all? And that's a huge, deep matter. And I was going to say that, for one, people write about it. They have these profound non-dual experiences, right, with or without psychedelics. And let's say without. And or intimations along those lines. You know, I've had myself, and then there's this saying in Tibet, you know, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. Sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. It's like a circle. And, you know, in the brain, there are key parts that, on the one hand, give us a sense of the distinction between self and world, and there are other parts that locate us in world. That's necessary, you know, to function. If you have a serious stroke, like Jill Bolte Taylor had, you can kind of blow out those distinctions for a while, and probably to some extent we can self-induce them. And then one way or another, though, or your mind can just get increasingly quiet, and it can just feel increasingly like there's only everything, you know, perceived from this particular perspective, but really this particular vantage point is not very binding, you know? And, you know, I've definitely have had those kinds of things, and I think you just start understanding more and more that whatever's happening right here is just one tiny little bit of thread in this vast tapestry of causes. And you start relaxing more and more into that. And I guess that's, I could say a lot more about that. That's a whole workshop thing. I'll leave it at that. And just to say that it's very easy to get heady or esoteric or craving even about that. And I think in a paradoxical way, as people open more down into themselves, they also open more out into everything, you know. And in terms of paths, I think there are fewer pitfalls in opening down into yourself as a way to open out into everything than the other common path of going up and out mystically. But I think there tend to be more risks with that, even though both can really work for different people. You know, I find for myself when I'm in a situation where I'm getting anxious, like to bring it down to earth, someone's saying something or I'm not so sure they're going to give me what I want. If I really get kind of fixated on them, I notice I start getting more fearful, right? And that's the tendency in the brain. When we feel any kind of negativity in the overall mosaic of reality, we tend to isolate down on that tile. And positive experiences, on the other hand, as Barbara Fredrickson and others have shown us, lead us to broaden out. So I notice that when I take a wider and wider and wider and wider view, I feel more peaceful and less disturbed. I have a larger context. You know, this is a kind of a very practical path into allness. You know, I see more of the whole situation. I'm taking more into account. I'm able to put it in a larger perspective in terms of time and space. You know, that's very helpful to feeling less fearful. Okay, and maybe another person or two. Great. Yeah.
So talking about this negative bias.
Yeah.
So in your book, Hardwiring Happiness, mm-hmm. you talk about that.
Yeah.
And you said that our negative bias is like the memory of, the memory of negative things is like Velcro.
Yeah.
The memory of positive things is like Teflon. Great, great analogy.
They'll probably put that on my tombstone. My wife's gonna put "still churning," but anyway. That's right.
But so the question is, and you explained that there are different types of memory systems for the positive memories and negative memories, and you sort of lost me there. What's the difference in the memory system?
Okay, kind of briefly, what I would say is that, thanks for repeating the question, thanks for the reminder. So the question is, is there a difference between in the brain between fear memory and other kinds of memory, or negative memories and other kinds of memories? Yeah, and what can we do with that, right?
What's the difference? Why is it that I remember something negative that happened to me?
Yeah.
And it's so easy to forget the positive things that happen.
Okay. Well, the why of it is that there are a lot of little mechanisms in the brain, you know, and a lot of them have to do with the relationship, briefly, between the amygdala, the alarm bell of the brain, and the hippocampus. They're very closely connected. And as information streams through us, it's a little bit like the amygdala is watching it, you know. Oh, pleasant, nice, neutral, neutral, pleasant, nice, unpleasant, wah, wah, wah. You know, it tends to do that, right? And when it does that, it's also talking to this hippocampus, which is right next to it, saying, you know, whether something really matters, okay? Pleasant, neutral, neutral, negative, remember this one. And so literally it stimulates, it directs, it excites the hippocampus to really start the memory forming process. And the hippocampus in turn directs other, if you will, networks in the brain to really hold on to this one. That's kind of the why of it is that's a great way to keep animals alive. And that's, yeah, that's broadly the how of it. For me, the takeaway a lot is to be, number one, very careful about that initial threat signal. Am I so threatened? No, usually no. And also, can I condition myself increasingly to just literally walk from the parking lot to the front door here without any feeling of fear? Walk across your living room with no feeling of fear. It's not so easy. You know, talk to another person, even in a friendly, easy way, without any sense of unease or apprehensiveness or vigilance or bracing or guarding. You know, what's it like to really soften into the other person without any sense of defendedness? You know, with appropriate boundaries and taking care of your interests, it's not so easy. But you can do that. You can gradually condition yourself. So you're getting fewer of those inputs in the first place. And then the other thing I personally do a lot, based on how the brain works, is when I do feel afraid, when I get that fire alarm going off in the back of my mind, I ask myself, is it hooked up to a preamp that turbocharges the signal, based on typically childhood or other previous life experiences? It's like the real scale of the threat on the 0 to 10 scale is like a 2, if that. But it hits this preamp based on our history, quack, and gets goosed up to a 6 or a 9. Right? So I try to see, oh, that's like an internal delusion. That alarm ringing is more like a false alarm. It's kind of annoying, like a car alarm going off that won't stop. But it doesn't mean that, you know, the car's burning or somebody's trying to break into the car. It's like a false alarm. Maybe one more person, then I have a final comment. Yeah.
I hope I can talk.
Sure.
I feel so blessed to be here tonight. Thank you.
I feel much the same to be with you all, truly.
Happy
New Year. Yeah. Actually, I'm going to interrupt you. I'm so sorry. If you think about this gathering right here, lately I've been thinking more and more about how the way we live is really it's unnatural in many ways. And one of the unnatural aspects is to feel peaceful amidst about 85 other strangers, most of whom are strangers, including, if I may say this as one myself, lone males, who are really the primal threat in hunter-gatherer times, a strange male, a lone male, you know. And so what's interesting is to watch, though, how often we can actually be with other people in a completely peaceful way, and then other people are actually not threats to us. I think a lot of times we just don't even notice it, but it's actually a wonderful opportunity to feel safer and safer with other people, to feel the goodwill of others, the unthreatenedness of others, the zillions of everyday moments where we're just fine with other people, and we can afford to lower our guard more and just kind of be more here, which gives us more cognitive resources than other kinds of resources for personal growth, insight, creativity, planning, joy, and all the rest of that. Thanks for letting me interrupt you there. All right.
So I think one of the themes of tonight's talk, so I've heard, has to do with fear, our fears, whether they're, you know, they come from within or the trait fears or anxieties, yeah, et cetera. And as an empath,
yeah,
and probably, you know, heavy empath, I also pick up other people's fears and their threats and,
yeah,
their angers, and so I know that has to do with boundaries, and I really have had this since I was a little girl, and it's very hard to develop, you know, so what happens for me is I start to pick up the other person's perceived threat by their behavior, because I'm observant and I see,
yeah,
and also based on what I hear them say and, you know, their body language, and all of a sudden they might shut down or they might become aggressive, and then I'm already feeling some of their fears and threats.
Sure.
And then what happens is, as I get stimulated, it sets me off, and I'm reminded of my own, you know, childhood stuff, and then I'm up all night analyzing why they were doing that, and then eventually I get to why I'm triggered, and I end up losing sleep. So how do you suggest not to get so stimulated that it usurps the whole rest of the day trying to settle down from somebody else's, you know, without my becoming their therapist necessarily?
Yeah.
Because I start doing that and writing letters and saying, this is what I picked up, and I'm up at night analyzing them, and then also, and I want to, I'm exhausted by the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you for that. And to sort of repeat it in a summary way, if I can do justice, what do you do? Yeah, we have compassion for others, we're very empathic, and we pick up their fears, okay? So a couple things. One is, precisely in proportion to how open someone can be, they need to grow the capacity to regulate themselves on the inside. And so the more intuitive a person is, the more empathic, even psychic they are perhaps, the more important is to have a really clear and rooted sense of, you know, to use a certain kind of language, the distinction between my karmas and your karmas, your streaming and my streaming, you know? They intertwine, to be sure, but there are distinctions between them. Otherwise, there could be no results that are linked to causes, in a way. It would just be all one big mush. So, and that's where the teachings of equanimity come in, where we find ways to be simultaneously profoundly open and compassionate, and also profoundly at peace with whatever we're aware of, right? That's, for me, part one. And then part two is, I don't know, I just don't find value, I guess, in getting wrapped up in things past a certain point I can't do anything about. And that's something, too, to let yourself say to yourself, you know, it's enough. You know, Sokni Rinpoche has a nice saying. He said, okay, think the same thought again and again and again, but 10 is enough. Right? You know, I think there's a place for hitting that off switch, and then we just don't have to do it anymore. The thing about fear, too, to build on what you said, and as I move to a wrap here tonight, is that most of our fears are meaningless. Fear is probably the very first emotion in evolution. It's a powerful internal signal. There's a term in psychology called signal anxiety, where we have a funny feeling and the body's telling us that something's wrong, or we're reading other people. So obviously, in terms of these two mistakes we can make, we don't want to ignore the fact that our boyfriend really is a creep, you know what I mean? Or that things are really going downhill with our teenager. We don't want to miss that. On the other hand, so much of our anxiety has no signal value. It's not informative. It's noise. It's just noise. And so one of the things is, though, that there's certain contents of mind that tend to be privileged. One is fear. Fear tends to be very privileged in the mind. We give it much power, and it's designed to have a lot of power to keep our ancestors alive. The other thought that tends to get very privileged in the mind is me, I, right? Fear is going to arise, right? Certainly for a long time, thoughts or feelings of I are going to arise. It isn't so much trouble that they arise. What causes trouble is that we give them power. We take them seriously. We identify with them, and we presume that they're true. And very often, the anxieties or apprehensiveness, the body sensations, that funny feeling in the pit of the stomach, you know, that we analyze and analyze and analyze, it's meaningless. Right? It's like trying to analyze cloud patterns for secret teachings or something. Okay. The last thing is move to a wrap here, that for me is like the fifth refuge I just want to kind of lay out, which is one that I know everyone knows here. It's, with regard to fear, the refuge of love. When we're grounded in love ourselves, that protects us with regard to our fears. It soothes us, it calms us, it settles us. And when we can choose to love or to choose to be loving in relationship to somebody else, we feel less frightened by them, feel less alarmed by them, less threatened by them. Again, it doesn't mean being a doormat or not seeing real tigers, but love is a profound refuge in helping us, you know, kind of calm down. And if nothing else, we can love that little scaredy cat inside each one of us. You can love that scaredy cat inside yourself, you know. You could talk to your own little Ricky inside, who's really scared of what might be lurking under the bed. I sit for a minute and call it a night. Sometime, if you want a kind of meditation for a minute or more, is on one breath, say quietly in your mind, may you be free of fear. The you being people in general, or perhaps a particular you, someone in your life, may you be free of fear. And then on the next breath, say quietly in your mind, may I be free of fear. Go back and forth, or just do one a lot and see what comes. Thank you, and may you be free of fear.
Thank you.
Thanks, little Ricky.